Okay, folks, welcome to Journey into Excellence, episode number 11. My name is Vernon Bohr, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. Journey into Excellence is an ongoing monthly series where experts in their fields will focus on how the evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking, civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. Each of our expert panelists brings something unique to the discussion, which they will share. Our panelists include Jack Malcolm, the president of Falcon Performance Group, an organization dedicated to improving the professionalism, preparation, and productivity of sales professionals in the complex sales environment. Dr. Martin Haysacker, a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Florida, and Brian P. Higley, Ph.D. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, LLC, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfaction in individual terms and organizations. So with that, I will let Dr. Higley, Brian, you kick it off, and you tell us where we're going to go today.
Sounds great. So what I thought I'd clarify is that last year, Journey into Excellence 2019, I think it was our first 8 episodes, we went into a pretty deep dive on how to define excellence. And to summarize that, basically we're defining excellence, at least for the sake of this journey, as clear thinking and civility. So excellence in this journey is reduction of common thinking errors so that we can think more clearly. And some of the common thinking errors that we went over last year that pop up in our discussions a little bit in this year are things like appeal to emotion, appeal to authority, appeal to bandwagon, appeal to anecdotes. Getting rid of some of these thinking errors so that we can think more clearly is one part of the way we're defining excellence on this show. The other part is civility, and again, we went into this in a pretty deep dive. I believe it was our first 8 episodes last year, where we're replacing coercion and threats with negotiation and fairness, where we're replacing intimidation with non-threatening behavior, where we're replacing emotional abuse or financial abuse with respect and shared responsibility. The way that we talked about it last year was framed through the equality wheel, which we sometimes call the civility wheel, versus the power and control wheel, which is what we sometimes refer to as the abuse wheel. So that's a little bit of where we were last year. This year, I believe it's our third episode in 2020. We're getting into trying to answer the question, if clear thinking and civility is so excellent, then why is it so rare? And so this year, I call it Journey into Excellence 2020. It's looking at one possible answer to that question, and that is because clear thinking and civility, aka excellence, takes a heroic journey in order to attain it. And so we're kind of looking through the process of the journey into excellence through the lens of a pretty popular hero's journey paradigm, Joseph Campbell's. And we're talking about 3 different phases when we talk about this heroic journey into excellence. The first phase is separation. The second phase is initiation, where you start to look into how can I separate from old ways of thinking and initiate myself into new, more excellent ways of thinking and being. And then the third phase is return, which is after I have become more excellent in the form of thinking better and acting more civilly, how can I give this back to myself and others in ways that impact my family system, that impact my education system, that impact my business system or my political system, whatever systems we're dwelling in. So that was that's the difference between last year and this year. Last time we went over 2 different stages in phase 1, separation, to complete that phase, and that was unexpected aid, where we get certain kinds of aid that we did not expect, and I gave the example of all of you being some of my unexpected aid I did not plan when I was 18 years old to meet all of you specifically. It just kind of happened, and it has really helped me in my own journey. And crossing the first threshold, which is crossing over from the norm, which is typically thought about as not so excellent in our thinking and our civility, and moving on to the journey toward excellence. And so that concluded the four stages of phase one of the hero's journey, separation. And to go over all of those different steps, the first is call to adventure, which is what I hope maybe this broadcast is for ourselves and others, calling people to the adventure of excellence. The second stage is refusal of the call, where for one reason or other, we might not step up to going after excellence. And I went over unexpected aid and crossing the first threshold. I think we'll always go back a little bit to that first phase of separation in our discussion. One of the things that I would like to discuss today and maybe the rest of the year, actually, is how the global pandemic is really a call to adventure to all of us. That's something that I think we can dive into. So we're leaving separation kind of behind, but I think we'll get back into the separation phase from time to time to move into the second phase, initiation. And there are a couple different steps that I thought we'd talk about today in terms of initiation. The first is belly of the whale, or sometimes I've heard it called belly of the beast. Basically, what this step is the dying or the leaving behind of certain things as we separate from old ways of thinking and being, and the metamorphosis into something different. So in terms of what we're talking about, it would be leaving behind less excellent ways of thinking and moving into a phase of thinking in more scientifically sound or critical ways, and then leaving behind some of the uncivil ways of the norm and starting to generate the energy and the focus to begin to act more civilly. And then after that, related to, I think, this belly of the whale where we're going through this metamorphosis, leaving some things behind to generate energy for new things, is what Campbell called the road of trials. This is something that I think Campbell put out there to let everybody know what I think is true about life, and that is that if you're going to pursue excellence, you're also going to be encountering endless challenges to life. And sort of circling back to separation, refusal of the call, I think one of the major reasons why so many people refuse the call to excellence, clear thinking, and civility is because they haven't been properly initiated into how to deal with the long road of trials. So with that, maybe I'll toss it on over to Marty and have him start us off as he usually does, talking about maybe some belly of the whale or road of trials related stuff within the family system, and then we'll just see where that takes us. Marty, does that sound good to you?
Sounds excellent. Marty, can I jump in and throw one thing out there really quick before you jump into your part here? Something sure. That struck me in what you said, Brian, that seems very central here, for me anyway, is one of the older gentlemen along here, is this notion of life as an adventure. Adventures are dynamic. And we live in a fast-moving time. We hear a lot of people as we enter this particular period of time in the world with this pandemic. If you look at it as an adventure in life, that might give you some power. That gives us some power because, after all, it is an adventure after the fact, based on the fact we don't know where it's going to go. So people always are dealing with it, boredom in life. And when life can be seen as an adventure, which Campbell talks about, I think that's an important aspect, whether it be from the day you're born till you reach my age, till you pass this planet. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yep, good segue. So one of the things that Brian reminded us of last time was that Campbell viewed this monomyth, this hero's journey, as a map that people can use to understand their experience. And so Vern mentioned that it would be useful to think about relating some of the themes of today's conversation to the coronavirus or COVID-19. And I think that this notion of the monomyth is right on point. The other thing I wanted to mention before I start my other comments is, Byrne said that life is an adventure, and the truth is we can select to experience life as an adventure, or we can select to disengage from life, or we can select to be tyrannized or terrified by the experiences that you could otherwise think of as an adventure. And so my first thought with regard to our listeners and each other and the COVID-19 virus is we get to make a decision about whether we're going to face this as one of life's great adventures, or whether we're going to face it by being sort of debilitated by fear and anxiety, or whether we're going to run away and not face it at all. And those are all themes that are available to us when we look at the hero's journey. So with regard to families and these two, so remember we've gone through the stage of call to adventure, refusal of call. So you could, to walk through the COVID thing on the family level, the call to adventure might have been the first time we realized that this virus had come onto American shores and that it potentially could affect our family or our loved ones. The refusal of the call might have been the experience that many of us had where we're like, ah, it's not going to be a big deal. It's going to be a few cases. It's going to be fine. No problem. It won't hit us. My family's fine because we're not old or we don't have a co-occurring disorder or whatever. Supernatural aid is the idea that that there will be a guide or a magical helper to help us. And, of course, what have we done in our nation? We've pulled up Anthony Fauci and some of his colleagues as supernatural aid, as people who have maybe insight and guidance for us that otherwise we wouldn't have. Crossing the threshold, we also talked about last time, but in a family model, this might be the place where we've decided we're going to give up trying to pretend life is normal. We're going to stop going to the grocery store every 2 days. The children no longer go to pre-K or elementary school, and the working people in the family are now working from home. So now we've gone from call to adventure to refusal of call to supernatural aid to crossing the threshold, and now where are we? We're a family who's in the belly of the whale. And belly of the whale is this notion that there's a final separation from the known world and the self, and we're into this other stage. We're into, so of the three stages of the monomyth, there's separation, initiation, and return. And what we've now done is left separation when we crossed the threshold, and we're now fully in initiation when we're in the belly of the whale, just like Jonah. So the notion here would be that, for example, there are family members who now live with us 24/7, when it used to be they spent 8 hours at work, or they spent 6 hours at school, or they hung out with their friends in the evening. All that's changed. And so so that's one way that the belly of the whale sort of happens. And another way the belly of the whale happens is people in our lives, family members, close people, people that were just like family to us, people we interacted with freely, openly, hugged them, saw them every day or two, now we're sequestered from them. They're distant to us. We can only now reach them through digital media or phones. So that's a sense in which the belly of the whale metaphor sort of maps onto the family's COVID experience. And then the next stage is the stage called the road of trials. And remember, the road of trials is a series of tests, tasks, and ordeals that we have to undergo to begin being transformed, according to Campbell's monomyth. That the person who's undergoing this often fails one or two or more times because it's a road of trials. And some trials you win and some trials you don't win. Mm-hmm. So how about in the family circumstance? It might be that I was trying to be a kind and decent family member and just erupted and started yelling with all the pressure of all the people trapped in the same place. Or it might be that I've given into a loneliness and despair because I can't touch and reach my loved ones. I can't hug them. I can't reliably get to them without risking them being infected or me being infected. So those are a couple of ways that I think families might be negotiating the COVID-19 and experiencing the belly of the whale, and then this road of trials or challenges. In fact, let me add one more set of road of trials or challenges. Many families are experiencing the trial of lost income. The work required face-to-face involvement, but it was non-essential work, and therefore they no longer are drawing a paycheck. Or conversely, the road of trial in many families is that one or more of the members who are workers are essential workers and therefore exposed to much greater risk of contracting the COVID-19 virus and bringing it home than they otherwise might have. So let me stop there.
Yeah, I've got quite a few comments, but I want to bring Jack on in. Jack, is there anything that came to your mind as Marty was speaking?
And by the way, Mal has joined us, just so you all know.
Hello, Mal.
Welcome, Mal.
Hey, good to join.
I like everything that you just said, Marty, and I think you took us through all the way through road of trials right now. But you left off something that I think is very important to some people. Fortunately, I believe none of us on this call right now is the ultimate trial is either getting the illness or having somebody you love getting the illness and succumbing to it or maybe getting through it. I'm experiencing the lost income. I'm experiencing the, you know, going stir crazy and all that. Although being fairly much of an introvert, it's not bothering me as much as it's bothering some of my friends. So it's really not that big a trial. So I believe all of us are pretty lucky, and it's one thing to talk about this as an adventure, but it's at some point the problem with this disease is that if somebody gets it, I think of a monomyth or this whole 17 stages as a testing stage and an ability to grow out of it. But if it kills you, it kills you. You're not going to grow out of it. It's not a test of character that determines whether you recover from this or not, as far as I can tell. In fact, the people with the character, the ones who are heroically volunteering to help other people, are the ones who are suffering the most.
You know, that makes me want to, I guess I'll spoil the entire story here, but I think we already spoiled it a couple of podcasts ago about where this whole paradigm sort of leaves us, the last stage, freedom to live. And one of the things that's brought up in freedom to live is this freedom from the fear of death, which is pretty, similar to a lot of what the existentialists, both psychologists and philosophers, spoke of, the freedom from the fear of death, which often leads to the ability to live. So as you were talking about that, Jack, I thought it just brought to mind the last stage of all of this, which is freedom from that fear of death so that you can live. But I hear your point that there are some of us who will not make this out. And I think that the hero's journey into excellence pertains to development while we're alive. So I see the point. Yeah. Mal, any thoughts from you so far? I don't know if you've heard enough to pipe in yet, but wanted to check in with you.
Yeah. Let's. I've been thinking more historically about this to give my students a better sense of context and perspective and the role that they can play during this pandemic to pierce the fears and denial and decadence and ignorance in society. And that when Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, it was a pretty bland platform in the midst of the crisis, but well-meaning people in the United States that became more sensitive to problems of lack of health care, poverty, and lack of social security were able to push through an agenda that made us more human and brought us together, the healing that came out of it. And I try to also let them know Germany took another path during that crisis and that they'll have some tough decisions, but they're on this road of trials, we have a national debate that's ongoing, and within our own history, we saw well-meaning people carry the day And I think there's some parallels with maybe Biden if he were to get elected. It's a pretty bland agenda, but well-meaning people can move us toward healing and unity.
Now, as you were speaking, I was hearkening back to our discussions last year about the power and control versus the equality wheel, and one of the spokes on both of those wheels was economic partnership versus economic abuse. And as you were talking, I've been thinking about a lot of the discussions within your realm of politics about, well, what do people in power do when there is a crisis? And as you were talking, I thought about, well, some take the path of the equality or stability wheel where they say we've got to find a way to partner up with everybody so we can get as many people through this as we can, whereas others take the path of the power, control, and abuse wheel that say, how can we take advantage of this to get more for ourselves and think less of other people? So I thought I'd just throw that out there.
Well, there's a lot that's been written on abuse of power during time of crisis, and some of those in a contemporary sense are looking at the $2.2 trillion bailout having about $500 billion that doesn't have much oversight, and that there have been changes in a number of laws that if they'd have been the lead news story that we're going to weaken the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, that would have been a lead story. We would have hopefully debated it some, and some of that gets pushed through as we're more than distracted, overwhelmed by dealing with the crisis. So, yeah, I think that's an important aspect to look at. And the tendency is to pull within and take care of your family, your church community, your community. And I want my students to keep looking at knowing international implications of this and try to rise above the personal challenges to become stronger citizens.
You know, Marty, that reminds me a little bit of what – oh, go ahead, Fern.
No, I was real simple. Something that comes to mind, this is actually both for Marty and Mal. Marty, probably more because you've probably been teaching a little longer. Just a quick thought here. Have you seen – what are the changes you've seen in students' attitudes in the way they view the world – throughout your teaching career? Because my sense is technology impacts society, it definitely shapes the thinking and minds of the youth of America, and you're constantly in touch with them. Could you make any comment on that?
So a couple thoughts. The first one is, I think Mal's got me beat on saddle time in the classroom. I think I've got 35 and a half years. I think Mal may have me eclipsed pretty well there.
He's invited in this too, by the way.
Yeah. I knew that. I just wanted to make sure. Pride of place probably goes to Mal.
Go ahead. That sounds like humble bragging to me, but
I was just going to say, I'm such a spring chicken. I'll just be quiet.
That's right. So, and another way in which I think Mal deserves pride of place is in general, I am teaching large lecture formats of undergraduates, a couple hundred people, 300 people. I do also do graduate seminars, but I don't have as much dialogue with them. A little bit of dialogue is pretty focused. The third thing is, you know, I'm biased. I'm always going to bring my own agenda into things. So I'm very cautious about making any kind of pronouncement about what I've seen as change over time. But having said that, let me jump right into it. The thing that I have seen that's been most surprising to me is how much flexibility the college students that I've worked with, and this is for 30 years, it's been University of Florida students. So just let me bracket that. Large public comprehensive university, you know, that's generally thought of as in the state of Florida among publics, probably, you know, as good as any. And it's in the top 10 publics nationally. So with that limitation, what I've noticed is that there's much more flexibility in students around issues about gender role, gender rigidity, much more acceptance around people who are deciding to do gender in a way different from what has been traditionally accepted. That, believe it or not, as funny as that may sound, that's the one thing that has really jumped out to me as a transformation over time. Then I think another piece of it is this particular group at the University of Florida. Over time, I've taught the same class for maybe a dozen years, and I've seen that collegians are shifting politically to the left. I mean, everybody jokes about them having been left, but a dozen years ago, it was felt like center left. And now it feels like there is a really strong core of people, at least in the psych classes, that are more like left of center left. Not everybody all the time, but that's also a pattern that I've noticed. So that's really what I have. I'm not sure if that was what you were asking about, but those are the two things I've noticed.
Marty, I have honest questions. I don't expect any particular answer. An honest question to
man.
Me is one with no agenda. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in what people have to say, and I will work with that. You know, that's sifting around in my head. Now,
I would agree with that, and some cautious musings. They read less. They're distracted mm-hmm. more with cell phones. They're a bit more self-absorbed, many of them. There is a shift to the left politically on cost of college, on health care, on minimum wage. They're more open to ideas of socialism or democracy applied in the workplace. They're more open on questions of race and ethnicity as well as gender. They volunteer in greater numbers. They're unaccustomed to dialogues openly on race, gender, ethnicity, and the economy. So the college provides a safe place where they can have that dialogue. And I find them, and this gives me a great sense of hope, that they are very open to new ideas. And if you don't push them too hard at first and you develop that trust, they'll stay with you and keep listening and asking questions. So I think it is, a sense of trying to stay with love and truth, kind of the fountains of youth. And they have certainly done that with me and given me a sense of hope. But they are at a disadvantage with the media landscape of the day, reading less, worrying about where they're going to fit into the economy, but open on ideas of gender, race, ethnicity, and the economy.
Jack.
You know, Mal, I'll piggyback real quickly on that, if you don't mind, Vern, to kind of map it on to the hero's journey. As I was listening to both of you, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I've had at least more – in my experience, more self-report of social anxiety. And the way I think about that through the lens of the monomyth is oftentimes students, if you could think about the call to adventure, sometimes the call to adventure is as simple as being called to state your opinion. And I think a lot of students are refusing that call because in some way, shape, or form of what I think about as the road of trials. When I ask students, well, why are you anxious about voicing what you believe, whether it be politically or whether it be on race or gender or whatever, oftentimes the answer seems to me to be something to do with, I'm not prepared for the road of trials that occurs if I say something and I offend somebody. So I thought I'd just piggyback on that, and maybe we can explore how voicing one's opinion in academia, and then I think the same is true when I talk with people in the work world and then the family world too, of how genuine self-expression can be a call to adventure that is refused, perhaps because people are not educated yet on how to deal with the road of trials that comes when somebody might dissent from what it is that you say. And I'll pass it on over to Jack and see what he thinks.
Well, I'm not sure that I have anything to add to that. I don't have contact on a regular basis with any students. I train adults. I work with adults, and I'm in and out for 1 or 2 days of training, and sometimes that's all I see people. My life intersects with them for just, you know, a couple days, so I don't have them like for an entire semester. Professionally, I tend to stay away from having conversations about politics or their feelings about the world and all that, because it's just, it's not a good idea to have these conversations with folks. So I'm not sure that I have a whole lot to add.
Jack, let me ask you something.
I'd like to dive in eventually, Vern, to the notion of it's not a good idea to delve into certain topics, because I'm really interested in that, because I think it does relate a little bit to Belly of the Whale and Road of Trial. So I just want to stick a pin in that and then let you go with where you want to go, Vern.
No, it's your show. Take over. Go. I'm just here to kind of channel a variety of things that come to my mind. Go.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think what Jack just said mapped on a little bit to what I've been, I just said about this, I don't know that I would call it social anxiety, but a certain amount of anxiety about expressing thoughts or even recruiting thoughts on certain topics because it's not a good idea. I think there's that general sense that it's not a good idea to do certain kinds of self-expression. And I think that relates a little bit to what we're talking about today as well. So I just wanted to delve a little bit deeper into that. I think a lot of students don't want to express themselves. I'll give you some specific examples. Students have come to me afterwards. Marty mentioned the perception of a left-leaning sort of group of students. And I think at the very least that students are perceiving it that way, so that sometimes students will come up to me after class and say, I actually lean a little more right, but I don't think it's a good idea for me to share those opinions because of, you know, they don't use these terms, but because I think it will present a whole road of trials for me. So what I try to do in students and myself, because I think part of the process of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit, which is what I think the hero's journey is about, at least in this culture, me, is to discuss, well, okay, you've got maybe this imagination of the road of trials that you'll be putting in front of you if you express something or other to somebody. Let's talk about what those imaginations are, whether they're grounded in reality, and if they're grounded in reality, how can you overcome those barriers to genuine self-expression. So that might be something that we explore a little bit in this Belly of the Whale and Road of Trials segment, is how I think people can answer certain kinds of calls to adventure, whether it's dealing with the pandemic or social anxiety in the classroom or avoiding talking with people in the workplace about certain things.
Brian, you bring up a really interesting point to me, because it sounds like me you're kind of talking about is how to effectively live in what's been called this gap between how we, our expectations, and how life actually turns out and manifests for us. Is that it when you go into a discussion about politics or something, religion or anything else, there's always the what the anticipated reaction you may get versus what actually happens, and you can be off either way. And so that I did a seminar on this years ago, and it never really registered. It took 20 years to register in my own head that, oh, I got it. Here's what I think, and here's what I anticipate out of life, and here's what actually happens. There's a gap to be bridged, and how can I close that gap so that my life that's dynamic and those things I don't have control over, I can live more effectively in that gap and live a more enriched life. And it reminds me of a quote here that I just want to read a very short part. Most salient characteristic of life is its urgency here and now without possible postponement. Life is fired at its point blank. And I found that to be the very opening sentences. We cannot put off living until we are ready. I'll read the whole. The most salient characteristic of life is its urgency here and now without any possible postponement. Life is fired at its point blank. And to realize that for me gives me a certain power over life, not to change things that are thrown out my way, thrown my way that I don't have power over, that I can't control over, like this pandemic. Realizing that what there is for me to do at this point, let's in this pandemic, I'll use that as the example, is to determine what my courses of actions are and what I'm willing to do, not do, and not be debilitated by it. And the last thing I'm going to say about that is I happened to see an interview of a retired SEAL who said that, you know, you're always scared in combat. When stuff's being shot at you, you're scared. But where that leaves you is, what am I going to do? Am I going to sit here and be scared? Or am I going to move to action under the fire? And that's why I asked the question in a way about the youth, is that in the journey into excellence, what I would like to call an adventure to life, is where power exists as far as I'm concerned, is how able are we to handle life that's fired at us point blank in the face of fear, in the face of happiness, sadness, all that stuff. And that in large measure, is what this whole series is about to me.
Vern, I want to reference the final stage of the hero's journey again as I listen to you. Kind of going back to what is thought about this idea of freedom from death so that you can live. And there are a variety of imagined deaths, I think, that are often in play. So going back to the student, if I say something that might be perceived to be more right-wing, if I think all my friends are left-wing, I could have a social death. I think in the workplace, same thing, I could have a social death, but I could also have a career death or a financial death. And so I think so much of what we're going to be getting into, from the call to adventure all the way to the freedom to live, which is the sort of final stage, I think we're going to keep going back to, okay, what do I do in the face of at least an imagined possible death, a social death, a financial death, a reputational death, and then what do I do? You call it a fire. What do I do in the face of that fire? And then the second thing for me is that fire real or imagined? And that's a whole other, I think, way to look at this as well. So I thought I'd throw that out there after listening to you.
By the way, don't anyone pay attention to me. I'm just an old man that doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm just floating down this river of life like you all are. And someone said a long time ago, I know how this turns out, and it turns out badly for all of us. I'm farther along in the parade.
The other day I was watching a farm-to-table cooking show where someone happily said, you know, these sheep have a fantastic life and then one bad day.
Yeah. Well, let me circle back, say a few things about what Brian was raising in regards to the hero's journey and democracy. We don't really teach our kids through any institution how to agree to disagree agreeably, as Jefferson would have put it, to respect other views. And it's made tougher now because the polarization in the country is more acute than probably any time since 1968. And Brian's working on that dialogue in the classroom, and I've been reading about it in the workplace. But we really don't teach it very well. And I suppose it's, you know, democracy lurching forward at some levels. At the national and international level, then falling back and all of these different trials at democratizing society. And we're clumsy at it. We for years didn't look at the experiments, you know, building on what Dewey was said in the classroom or building on what was said in the workplace. They were kind of separate from democratic decision making at the national and state level. I'm not sure exactly how we teach them to agree to disagree agreeably, but it's seemed to be an essential foundation for where we want to go in creating a more just society.
Mal, as you were speaking, I was thinking of a lot of the expertise literature, and one of the ways to look at it, I think I brought this up before, is the 10,000 hour, 10 year approach, where you're focused like crazy on what it is that you want to become good at for at least 10,000 hours over the course of 10 years. You're open to constructive criticism because, and I think constructive criticism is another way to think about road of trials, because it can be very trying to have 10 years of constructive criticism. And you're open to your weaknesses, which again, I think could be considered another aspect of the road of trials, because it can be very trying to have someone for 10 years exposing your weaknesses. And as you said, I don't know how we teach this. I think that model, along with the equality or civility wheel, can be one answer to that question, is I think helping people to understand the difference between an equality or civility way conceptually, and then having actual experiences in the classroom, and I think also in the workplace. I do some work like Jack does in the workplace as well, of helping people to actually work on this stuff with an understanding that if it's new to you, then you're going to have a lot of weaknesses, and that's okay. But I think one of the reasons why people aren't doing this call to adventure, to democracy, this call to civility, this call to better thinking, is that they don't understand the road of trials as the road of the expert, which is a 10-year, 10,000-hour experience of having your weaknesses exposed and having tons of constructive criticism. And I think that's where a lot of this, whether it be social anxiety or anxiety about a career death or anxiety about being marginalized, comes from, is that I don't think we do a good job of helping people to understand the roadmap from novice to expert. And that roadmap is this 10-year long road of trials of lots and lots of mistakes and weaknesses and constructive criticism.
I think if one good thing comes out of this pandemic is that maybe there will be a renewed respect for expertise in this country.
Mm.
Because I think that's been a major problem over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5, maybe longer years, where it's become fashionable to deride the experts or to call them a deep state or to call them whatever, everybody's biased or whatever they're saying is fake. And I call it willful ignorance, that people revel in the fact that they don't know. Now, but they think they know because they have common sense. And now we're finding that we're facing a problem that we need experts to get us through. We need to listen to the experts. I'm hoping that I'm hoping that's going to last.
And Jack, as you talk, I think we've got to also know enough about expertise to even recognize the experts, because of this age of influencing, so many people are trying to influence without expertise.
Yeah.
And so if we don't teach expertise models, then people can get confused about who experts even are.
Well, and also I think that people have to recognize that the experts are the ones who sound least sure of themselves.
Yep.
Because they're honest with the limitations of the knowledge that they have.
And they're not suffering from the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect.
Unfortunately, you know, you've heard of the wisdom of the crowd, but we tend to follow the wisdom of the loud. And the people who speak the loudest, the people who speak the most confidently, are the pundits on TV who get the most airtime. And they can be wrong and never be called out on it, but they still keep getting the airtime.
So I want to point out really quickly from last year, Jack, then this is back to our theme of clear thinking and civility and how they're related. I think you're pointing out the problem with the fallacy of appeal to authority. If someone talks a certain way, if they look a certain way, they do certain things that have potentially nothing to do with that 10,000-hour, 10-year road
of
trials.
Well, appeal,
of criticism,
it depends
weaknesses.
On which authority you're appealing to, because if you're appealing to the right authorities, the ones who have put in the 10 years, who have put in the years of study, and all that who follow the data and who follow the evidence, then there's nothing wrong at all with appeal to authority. In fact, they're the only ones you should be listening to.
I call that appeal to expertise to differentiate from the balance.
Okay,
Brian, you bring up something really important. I just need to jump in here. Is just because someone's got and this is a dilemma, by the way, as far as I'm concerned. Just because someone's got credentials behind their names doesn't mean they have the expertise in the field
they're
talking about. And that's what typically get, you know, is Dr. such and such is says whatever. Well, if his, if his degree is in something else that he's not talking about, that gives him no more credibility than anyone else out there that has an opinion, and the opinions are only as good as how studied someone is. And I think it's important to recognize that regarding the effectiveness of pundits, Jack, you said this, and I happen to be going back through, I'm re-listening to Thinking Fast and Slow. And I jot down these passages from time to time that strike me. And this one really did, because it says the illusion of pundits, the idea the future is unpredictable, is undermined every day by the ease with which the past is explained. Our tendency to construct and believe coherent narratives of the past makes it difficult for us to accept the limits of our forecasting ability. Everything makes sense in hindsight. And I've been fascinated by this for a long time, because we live in a day and age of technology where I'm really convinced that people, they're able to articulate well. Thomas Sowell says it another way. He says some of these so-called thinking people could more accurately be described as articulate people whose verbal nimbleness evades evidence and logic. And I think it seems to me that we're living in that kind of age. But that's the wisdom of the crowd. I'll shut up.
And Kahneman's a good source for that. Philip Tetlock has written a couple of excellent books on that, about expertise and about who gets the airtime. He's done a lot of empirical studies as to who tends to be right over the long term, and it's the people who express uncertainty that tend to be right. And he talks about the hedgehogs and the foxes. And, you know, a hedgehog is somebody kind of like, I think, as you were describing, Brian, the expert who has spent a lifetime studying one particular topic. As long as you listen to the hedgehogs on that topic, then they're probably okay. But the problem is, as Vern said, is when they stray from that topic. And the people who tend to be the better pundits are the foxes. They may know one thing very well, but they also know a lot of other things. They have a lot more breadth in their knowledge, and they're willing to take in a lot more information, a lot more conflicting and diverse forms of information from other sources too, which also tends to, I think, tamp down their potential for being spectacularly wrong in some cases.
So I wanted to mention quickly two things that sort of sprang to my mind. The first one is inspired by what you just said, Jack. When I was the chair of the psychology department at Florida many years ago now, one of the things I came to realize is that I and my colleagues, because we were truly expert at one thing, made the error of believing we were expert at everything.
Yeah.
and of course that comes with, you know, you're called doctor or professor all day, every day, and, you know, all that stuff. But that's a very important thing to have, what we now call intellectual humility, which means that you have a real right sizing of what you know and what you don't know and what you think you know that isn't so.
Right.
So I would argue that, in fact, Fauci the other day, I think it was, that may not have been Fauci, but it was another scientist whom I respect, said the minute we start feeling a sense of overconfidence or arrogance, the science has stopped.
Yep.
And
by the way, just as I've been actually reading on this, there was an article in yesterday's New York Times called Embracing the Uncertainties of the Pandemic. And if you look it up, it's really fascinating. I actually went and I've read about half of the paper that it's based on, but they talk about what they call epistemic uncertainty, a lack of knowledge about the past and the present, versus aleatory uncertainty, which is a lack of knowledge about the future because it may be unknowable. You may not know the odds, or you may not know what can happen. And it's a real good article because it talks about how experts express uncertainty and how they can do that and still maintain their credibility with the audience. So that's something that I'm kind of looking into. I'm thinking of writing an article on that, or at least trying to learn a little bit more about it myself.
And I would say, Jack, that those, back to our theme of excellence as clear thinking and civility, that those who have taken that 10-year, 10,000-hour or so road of trials to expertise on clear thinking, sometimes thought about as central route processors, you will get credibility from those central route processors when you do express uncertainty, because they are such good thinkers that they can automatically pick up on somebody who says, oh, yeah, I know exactly what's going to happen in the future. They're just too good a thinker for that to get by. The problem is, I think, is that call to adventure to become a truly expert thinker, I don't think it's promoted well enough in any of our systems, the family system, the education system, or the leadership system. And so maybe this podcast could be a call to adventure for as many stakeholders in those systems as we can get interested to take that 10,000-hour, 10-year journey or so to become somebody who is less entranced by fallacy and more influenced by more valid thinking.
Well, I wonder if some of that goes back to what Mal said about his perception that students read a lot less. And I'm not really sure how you can be an expert without really doing some hard reading and some deep reading in certain things. I've always been fascinated by the fact that Abraham Lincoln had the grand total of about 3 months of formal education in his entire life. But he would walk 8 to 10 miles, borrow a book, and read the heck out of it by, I don't know, firelight or candlelight or whatever. And I'm just using him as an example, that people would read a book and they would pull so much out of it. You know, I'm embarrassed to say I read a lot more books than Abraham Lincoln ever did, but I nowhere near come close squeezing the knowledge out of them that folks like he did.
I wanted to,
Jack, you're making me think of something that I'm actually having quite a few discussions with in quite a few classrooms, because my classrooms are a mixture of both the content and actual discussions about the kind of learning that you're talking about. And we're having lots of discussions, and this maybe gets back to the question I think Mal put forth of, you know, how do we do this better? Lots of discussions about mastery goals versus performance goals. Performance goals are what a lot of students are conditioned to pursue, and those are just doing certain activities that get them points, to the point where lots of students, and this might be a decent explanation for maybe why students, if it's true, you know, read less. If you can figure out a way in terms of performance goals to read less in order to get more points, you'll do it. And if your system is set up that way, you're actually reinforcing the behavior of less reading behaviors through these performance goals. The other sorts of goals that we talk about in learning are mastery goals. And these have to do with taking on that road of trials, 10-year, 10,000 hours or so, of exposing your weaknesses, of constant criticism. And a lot of that can be facilitated by 10 years and 10,000 hours or so of reading. And these are students who oftentimes in certain systems, there are a couple of articles about this. I'm forgetting the author's name. Maybe Marty knows them. But they've done some analyses in certain education systems and found that mastery students are often punished because they want to dig deeper into something. Meanwhile, the system does not reinforce digging deeper into something. It actually reinforces going onto the surface of things in order to get your point. So that might be one explanation for why students are reinforced to read less, because, you know, if you think about these things from a systems perspective, it's not the student's fault per se, it's just an indicator of what the actual system is reinforcing. So if students are reading less, that would be one piece of evidence that our education systems are reinforcing less reading, possibly reinforcing more performance goals and punishing the mastery goals that lead to actual expertise.
So I wanted to, I think this takes this in a sort of a slightly different direction, but it's something I want us to consider, which is, on the one hand, I think all of us on this blog celebrate scholarship and careful thinking, data analysis, careful reasoning. What I want to introduce is, I think, a potentially uncomfortable topic, and it's the topic of why is it that large swaths of the American electorate sort of rejected the expertise model that Jack, I think, rightfully laments the disregard of. And the discomfort factor here for me is I wonder whether, and I am part of this, I wonder whether intellectuals and scholars and other people who do lots of system two database evidence-driven behavior have created or at least have created the perception of having created an intellectual oligarchy where only the most highly educated, only the people who speak with words that not everyone clearly understands have real access to power and influence in our culture. And the reason I raise this is because there is wisdom in people's behavior. It's one of the core tenets of behavioral science and psychology. And so when large numbers of people are rejecting what has been, for example, 50 years of sort of assumed wisdom about how to govern and how to lead and how to make decisions, something is going on that is worthy of our attention and engagement. So let me just stop there.
Brilliant, Marty.
Well, I would like to say a few words about that and circle back to why we're so polarized, a new book by Ezra Klein. It's really a lot of social psych where he sees us customizing our reality and rationalizing our feelings and drifting into a tribal nature. We're not embracing clear thinking and the role of science, and we seem to be digging in more into our partisan and cultural differences. And I thought it's noteworthy that as President Trump was trying to deal with the pandemic, that his popularity ratings and his approval ratings were going up, even as he showed inept and thoughtless leadership and was willing to contradict the scientists. He seems to have slowed up some on that, but it hasn't diminished his approval ratings. And I think it's possible that what comes out of this is, as was suggested, I forget who mentioned it, the role of science will be enhanced and looked at differently, primarily by those that had supported President Trump, that they had rejected science. And at times I look at the president's ideas about how to take certain drugs now, and I think this is kind of science versus snake oil. Because he's somewhat compelling with his confidence-driven approach on things, still is able to carry the day. So I think we're looking at a lot of rationalization of people's feelings as opposed to openness to where the science can take us, in part because it's so threatening. And it would mean that they have to admit that they've been wrong and they're friends, and they don't want to face the social problems of not being accepted within their peer groups or churches if they were to admit that they've been wrong on this.
And now I'm circling back to what we talked about in terms of knowledge of the expertise path, this road of trials that's filled with criticism and exposure of weakness. And as you were talking, I couldn't help but think, what if in our family systems, education systems, and leadership systems, we were better at giving people this math of the expertise path, this 10,000-hour, 10-year or so commitment to just having your thoughts battered about by people who know more than you. I think we could normalize mistakes like that so that it would be easier for all of us to say, oh, I was wrong 10,000 times, and know that, hey, that's the process of becoming more expert, is when all these other experts are showing me that I'm wrong, which then gets back to the final component, I think, of the hero's journey, this freedom to live from, that comes from freedom from a fear of death. And I think you were talking about a sort of social death where people fear, oh, if me being wrong gets exposed, then I'll experience some sort of social death. If we could replace that fear of a social death with some kind of acknowledgement that we all go through these roads of trials where our ideas were shown to be suboptimal or wrong over and over and over again, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's exactly what you need to do in order to become an expert at something.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think that people who don't respect science forget is, you know how they love to tell you, well, you know, the scientists said one thing 5 years ago, and now they're saying something else. They're wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the strength of science. Mm-hmm. Is that it can find out when it's wrong, and it will admit when it's wrong, and it will trumpet the fact that it was wrong. And then the good scientists will realize, well, we're probably still wrong, but maybe we're less wrong than we were before.
Mm-hmm.
Central to your comment.
Yeah, I think, Jack, that maps on pretty nicely to some of the concepts that we talked about last year on the podcast, tied into the equality wheel. And some of the things that I think about on the equality wheel was the concept of honesty and accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talked about, and Vern, you and I have had some discourse between now and our last podcast about this, of owning your mistakes, owning when you were wrong, keeping record of it, and like Jack said, trumpeting it. I think that's an equality or civility wheel practice where you say, I'm honest about it, and I take accountability for it, and I'm proud of the fact that when I'm wrong, I admit it. And the opposite of that, in many ways, on the power control wheel or the lack of civility wheel, is minimization, denial, blame, and distortion. And I think yet another thing that we could probably do to get back to, I think it was Mal's theme of, well, how can we get better at this? And our overall theme on the podcast to try to offer not just philosophy, but some practical things that we can do, is to help people to become aware of the difference between minimization, denial, blame, and distortion, and honesty and accountability. And I think what I just said before, an understanding that messing up is a part of this road of trials toward expertise, to just normalize being wrong, because we have to be wrong over and over and over again to get better and better and better at what we do.
We're such an either-or culture, though, I suggest, which is very interesting, because when you were talking, Brian, a minute ago about what we reinforce, what, performance versus, performance versus goals?
Mastery.
Versus
performance goals,
okay.
Versus mastery. Let me perform to get my grades versus let me actually become a more of an expert at this. Let me master this topic.
Right. And I've become intrigued by that because you often hear as well, you know, students are being taught for the test. They're not really being taught to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've come to, it puts a big smile on my face, is because that's an either-or thinking, is just because you're being taught for the test doesn't mean you can't learn as well, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, all of you that are in academics, as I was for many years of my life, also know that at some point along the way, certainly with PhDs and master's degrees, you are tested, and part of moving along and moving up the ladder is being an effective test taker. So they're not mutually exclusive, and yet we're so either or that we give ourselves outs to fail, so to speak. And the other thing too is that everything in life, that has all of life, is a mastery journey. You will, the best you even the best will fail a percentage of the time. You can reduce your failure rate maybe, but you're very rarely are people 100%, even the masters. And Marty, what you said, for me, there again, just my opinions, is brilliant, because I keep telling people more and more these days, from my perspective, is it's what important to see how the other person sees it. Because if someone sees it differently than you, and all you're doing is hammering on them about how wrong they are, how much you have their head up the wrong place and don't understand this and that, if you intend to accomplish something or move them in a way that empowers them, that's not going to do it, in my opinion. I've just never seen that work that way. So I tell a lot of people that in terms of science, and Jack, I'll shut up here because Jack made that comment, but I'm having been a scientist, the opposite of the argument you made is someone that talks about the consensus in science. Not that consensus isn't important, but it's not the consensus that defines the science. This goes back to shooting the messenger rather than the messenger. The message versus the messenger, you know, is the science needs to stand on its own. I don't care how many scientists believe that. We've got many things. And by the same token, if there's consensus, there's a likelihood, and I'm going to shut up in a second. Jack, tell us what aleatory means. I looked it up, but I think it's important for the listening, those listening, if they don't look it up, to have an understanding about that.
Well, aleatory comes from the Latin, I think, for dice. Has to do with games of chance. And in the way that we're talking about here, aleatory is about the uncertainty about future events, things that may be unknowable because you may not know the odds. It's different, I would think, than knowing, and it's kind of funny, games of chance, most of the time you do know the odds. But aleatory uncertainty is about not knowing what the odds are, because there's just so many things that can happen. Like for example, the odds are that somebody in the world today is going to get hit by lightning and killed. I'd say that's probably 100% chance of that happening. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But none of us know, and it's unknowable as to whether one of us will be that person. Just to give an example, did that help answer your question?
No, that was very good. The way I understand it and reading it is the absolute minimum uncertainty you could have about something.
Absolute minimum uncertainty.
And I think because, it's an example of what I'm talking about in terms of clear thinking. I think people who can talk in a way that Jack just did about what the odds are, but the difficulty of applying those big, large odds down to individuals is something that I think clear thinkers understand. But I think they only understand it if they go through this road of trials where they really start to think in much clearer ways than people who maybe have more performance goals. I think, Vern, you made a good point about black or white thinking, which is a fallacy we covered last year. So you can have performance goals, you can have mastery goals, but I think in every goal maybe there's a little bit of both. But if you're more focused on performance and less focused on mastery, you won't be able to conceptualize and communicate what Jack just did about odds and how they relate to individual people.
Yeah, Brian, I want to say about black or white thinking is that the Jack also brought up epistemic uncertainty. And black-white thinking could be the epistemology, that's what I was suggesting, through which Western culture in many respects sees the world. And you see it in things that people write and post and all it's either or. And that's why I gave the example of teaching for the test. It struck me one day as, wait a second. Yeah, you can be teaching students for the test, but that doesn't mean they can't be learning as well.
You know,
exclusionary.
Yeah.
That's all I was trying to And learning.
I think that level of thinking isn't available to someone who's doing too much performance goals at the cost of mastery goals. So to me, it just keeps coming back to
I want to go back to the I want to tack back to honoring the organism, honoring the individual. So in other domains, we actually praise people for making thoughtful, reasonable allocation of their efforts. So there are times when we just satisfy. Good enough is good enough. And then there are mm-hmm. times when we want to go all out. So when my students mm-hmm. are just studying for the test, what I understand is that as they do the calculus of their lives, as they organize themselves and husband their resources in the most effective ways they know how to do, they're deciding that allocating more than X units of effort to my class is not consistent with their highest purpose. And so maybe I'm sad about it, but I understand this person who's decided to just cram at the last second has made a series of decisions about where his or her efforts are best implemented.
Yep.
And I've made a different decision on my side. So mm-hmm. even with that, I think we need to honor that people are making decisions, perhaps ones we wouldn't make, but they're making decisions from a different value system, different perspectives, different demands, different contexts. And so it might be important for us to sort of understand that rather than to try to wish it into being something different as quickly.
I think that's a good point. It comes back
for a little. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it comes back to something that I think I said earlier, quoting Will Rogers, is we're all ignorant just about different things. And flipping that around is we're probably all experts just on different things.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when we look down on somebody for not having the expertise or caring about the expertise that we care about, we should remind ourselves that they probably know a heck of a lot more about something that we know nothing about. So that's a good point to bring up, and it's something that I'm going to take on board.
Yep.
And I think that relates to, I just want to pop in really quickly and map that sure. on to equality wheel versus power and control wheel.
And yeah, then Mao gets to talk.
Yeah. I think an equality or a civility response is exactly what Marty and Jack are talking about, a respect-centered, Carl Rogers, a famous psychologist, called it a positive regard-centered or empathic-centered way of looking at other folks. So I think a lot of times what gets conflated is a discussion of expertise and then a different but maybe a related construct, which is ability to hold people in high regard. So I
good.
Think sometimes one of the reasons why people either don't take or they're not good at influencing people to take that road of trials journey is because they think that constructive criticism must come with some kind of disregard or looking down on. So I'm really glad that we're talking about the difference between promoting expertise and being somebody who is disregardful or abusive.
Go, Mal.
Yeah, I was just going to mention regarding the mastery method that I have a number of students that aren't well-prepared or well-motivated, and I let them rewrite tests, and sometimes in order to get a C, they have to rewrite it three times. And I've always wondered, how much do they actually remember 5 years later?
Mm-hmm.
Those students mm-hmm. that had to rework it three times, that talked with me about it, might well remember it much better. We don't
Absolutely.
Have any tests for what students remember 5 years down the
mm-hmm.
road or 10 years down the road. And I've taken to musing publicly, tell them really the A is when you speak truth to power with love in the public square. And they're looking at me. And usually if I don't go too quickly with the class and I talk about my failures during the journey, I can develop enough trust that more of them are with me and I can broaden the discussion in class. When I introduce myself, I tell them arguably the silliest question that I asked when I got to South Korea was about what a student's sports programs look like in high school. And, of course, they don't have time for those programs because they're all studying at cram schools on Saturdays to get into colleges. But I let them know that. And I said, by traveling, I'm able to ask these questions and see things in a better perspective, and I think that's part of the learning process. The kind of musings on mastery method and to try to clarify the process of learning through failures to humanize the teacher. And I think there's probably some great work to be done on the mastery method, on what people actually do retain 5 and 10 years down the road.
Yeah, you're making me think, Mal, as you were talking, I thought of a theory that I often think about when I think about what people retain. I think a lot of what people retain are things that they have intrinsic motivation to retain. Excuse me. And self-determination theory is a evidence-based theory to kind of explain that. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the different components of motivation that these researchers identified. The first one being more extrinsic stuff, so that would be they're doing things for points and grades. The second one has to do still with more extrinsic kinds of reinforcement. They're doing things to avoid guilt or shame. And then after that, I think about what to me and what the research says, which is more important than me, increases people's intrinsic motivation. And that has to do with doing things because it relates to their own goals, not our goals, as I think Marty was alluding to. Doing things because it aligns with their own values, and then doing things because they intrinsically enjoy it. So one of the things that I've been trying to do, both in classrooms and when I'm out in the work world, is try to get a sense of what people's goals, values, and preferences are, and working with them to try to create learning experiences centered around those three things, because that's what the research tells us is going to link them to more intrinsic motivation. And the more people are intrinsically motivated to do things, I think the more likely it is that they'll actually retain the material and seek to master it.
So, Mal, I'm very happy that you brought up this book, Why We're Polarized. It actually reminds me of a 1991 book that was very influential on me that sounds like it's dealing with the same issue, and that's Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s Disuniting of America. So I'm gonna dive into this and thank you.
Well, I've been struggling with the best way to explain that to students for years, and it's the best overview that I've seen. It's the gift of making it readable. It's kind of like Malcolm Gladwell's work, but a little bit more systematic and a little less popularized, but very accessible. And I think the next time I teach a class on political parties, that'll be part of the readings. And it's quite sobering to see the tribal nature, the loss of independent voters as people dig into their positions as opposed to listen to the other side, and the fractured nature of our media now with Fox and talk radio and blogs, and the demonizing of moderate mainstream sources. And it's a thorough demonization that's right out of Germany in the 1930s has caused us to drift into being more tribal and more polarized. I look forward to your comments on it.
Marty, I want something from you.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
You brought up something earlier that I think it's really easy to gloss over, and that is that gap between academia and the average, if you want to say there is such a thing, working guy out here, and this trust, this distrust that seems to be coming out in our society. I'd like you to comment more on that.
Yeah, so actually, when you were responding to my comments and then as Mal was talking, what jumped into my mind was a quote that I'm going to probably partially mangle by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who said, in America, there are two imaginary political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, and two real political parties, the winners and the losers. The Democrats are run by the winners. The Republicans are run by the winners. And the one thing sure on election day is that winners will win. And whether you agree Whether you agree with that statement or not, I think that that statement would ring true for lots and lots of voters who supported the Trump administration, who are skeptical of government, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I know that winners are wealthy people, but also part of wealth in this nation is intellectual wealth, is scholarly wealth. So I am I know that's part of it, and I know I'm. You know, I'm not particularly wealthy, but I certainly am pretty high on the food chain on the other thing Americans have for many years revered, which is this sort of science expertise stuff. So I blob myself into that group of basically oligarchs, people who have at least a felt sense that they know best. And I'm not proud of it. I'm much more resonating with what Brian said, that we need to have We need to have a genuineness, empathy, positive regard for all people. But that's the flavor of this. And then the other layer on it for me is that what's happened in both of the current political parties is, which Vonnegut argued are run by the winners, and so the so-called losers lose every time, is that they're being ripped apart. Each of those political parties, I think, is being ripped apart. I think Donald Trump does not represent traditional core Republican values, and I think Bernie Sanders, who in many ways has captured the hearts and minds of the future of the Democratic Party, has values that are sometimes at pretty significant variance with widely accepted Democratic Party principles. So all of this together says to me there is a group of people who are clamoring, both in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party, for recognition, for acceptance, for engagement. And, let me just stop there.
I want to say something real quick about that.
It was
just brilliant.
Do you mind if I just jump in real quick? I just wanted to say, as I was listening to Marty, you were talking about what people are essentially yearning for. I get a sense that that so many people, maybe – almost everybody, I don't know, maybe I'm overdoing it there, but that we are all yearning for what I referenced before and then you referenced me referencing, a genuine regard and empathy from other people and to other people. And I think that's part of this journey into excellence in terms of clear thinking and civility is understanding, well, what do most of us really want? And I think folks like Carl Rogers and others who have been doing the research on this have found that almost all of us are yearning for regard and empathy to and from other people. So that just kind of came to me as you were talking. Go ahead, Vern.
Well, that ties into what I was going to say, Brian, in a way, because I think the problems that you described, Marty, actually is can be expanded to say it's the same thing we face with the old and the young. The young don't think that the old have anything worth saying because they don't understand the technology. The old think the young don't have anything worth paying attention to because they don't have the wisdom. And so across the board, and where it ties into what Brian said, something I've been fascinated personally because I've done a lot in technology over the years, is when you're working with computer-type systems and stuff, they try and build in protocols so there's a confirmation of what's being sent and what's being received on the other end are translated the same way, so they understand one another. And I think it's very what I've been finding in my own life for many years is that many things get stuck, not because the two parties don't understand each other, but there's not the appropriate feedback between the two, that the other person has the sense that they've been understood, or as Brian said, got the empathy. Is two people are going back and forth covering the same ground over and over because they don't have a sense of having been gotten. It's one thing to know that someone understands what you're trying to communicate to them and doesn't agree with you. That's in my life anyway. And a very different one when I'm trying to communicate something and I don't have the sense that I've communicated what I'm attempting to get across. And it can be as simple as saying, well, and Brian and I get into some of these from time to time, is if I'm tracking you, this is what I think you're saying. And sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. And therein, it seems to be a gap, as far as I'm concerned, with us as humans, not in the right way or wrong way, that that we can bring something to the party to bridge in terms of the empathy, as Brian says, is you're not right or wrong. I may not even know what you're trying to communicate.
Well, I want to respect everyone's time, Vern. Do you think it's a good time to maybe get everyone's last
It's whatever you guys want. Yes, since you guys are all the busy ones here. You're the important people. I'm just a little fly. As my father used to say, I'm just a little carbuncle on the ass of life. and I'll edit that out for anyone that might find it offensive. Bless his soul, he passed a couple of years ago, but that was another one he used to say. Yeah, you want to start us off, Marty? You want to wrap it up, whatever you have to say? He's there. He looks active. Brian?
Yeah, I'll just double down on what you said, Vern. I think it was it's a great point, eloquently stated. And going back a little bit to this hero's journey, the call to adventure. I think that that at least from my perspective, that you have called all of us to do in your last statement is try to understand people a little bit more, try to judge them a little bit less. Try to track them, try to give them statements like you do to me from time to time, Vern, is if I'm tracking you right, you're saying this. And I think that the more we can fill that gap between what I'm saying and what you're hearing with these little confirmation notes, am I understanding you correctly, the more we'll be giving each other what I think so many of us really want and what so much of the evidence of what's good for people says we need, and that is the feeling that somebody else cares about what we're actually saying and who we actually are. So I think I'll end with that.
So I'm Mark? Unmuted now. I'm unmuted now. My brain sort of evacuated with hearing the word carbuncle, so I'm probably done.
I'll edit that out. That could be too offensive for the youth of America.
I liked it.
Maybe not, because they might have to look it up and they don't read his mouth. So. And
actually,
sorry,
you know,
if you're a young person listening.
My final note actually has two components that have to do exactly with that reading issue. One of the things I see is that the students in my world are obtaining lots and lots of information. Some of it is by reading, but not necessarily by books. Some of it is by listening to podcasts and TED Talks. I can't tell you, dozens and dozens of students will start a conversation with, have you seen the TED Talk on blank? I think maybe the channels of information are different, but at least in my world, students are very appetitive intellectually. And all the students all the time? No, but a lot. And so I feel good about that. That'll be sort of my last word. Thank you.
Jack.
Well, I'm looking. I printed out the 17 stages of Joseph Campbell's monomyth to prepare for this. And I see that we've gotten through Rota trials in our conversation. So I'm really hoping that by the time we meet next, I will have met the goddess and fallen into temptation. And that's all I can say about that.
Count on it, buddy. Count on it.
It's either that or a carbuncle.
Mal, and we're so pleased to have you with us here today. We've missed you. Go ahead.
Thank you. It's been great to join. And next time we might look at the Iron Law of Oligarchy, impacting all systems and moving away from equality and civility. And at a personal level, I've tried to play with the theme of free in the home of the brave and talk about when we're brave enough to see ourselves and others, we'll start to know that we're sisters and brothers. So that's my macro and micro thought for the discussion.
Wow, wonderful. And with that, thank all of you gentlemen, as usual. It's been an inspiring dialogue and conversation for me. Thank you for including me, allowing me to be your host here. And take care of yourselves. Be well through whatever we're facing. And we will definitely catch you next month. And Brian, thank you for always bringing it back to the central theme, our hero's journey. Until next time, signing out, gang.